So your head and neck patient needs a replan? Close your eyes and imagine a faster way to get high-quality plans ready for your patients. RadFormation has a suite of tools that can accelerate this process. Quickly contour, perform any image deformations, evaluate the plan sum, and run secondary calculations all in one efficient ecosystem, all while keeping you and your clinical expertise in the driver's seat. Visit RadFormation.com to learn more.
Welcome to the Accelerators Podcast. We're bringing you oncology news and views with guests from all over the field. The discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. The Accelerators is part of the Photon Media family of podcasts. You can check out all of our shows at photonmedia.org. All right, welcome back to the Accelerators Podcast. This is Matt Spraker. I'm coming from Denver, Colorado, radiation oncologist here with my co-host.
Simmel Parikh here from Lake Huron Medical Center in Port Huron, Michigan.
And I'm Austin Hopper, a PGY5 resident at UC San Diego.
And I'm Jonah Hottengotti-Gluth, radiation oncologist and professor at UC San Diego.
Yeah, thanks for so much for joining us. This is so exciting. We have some San Diego natives kind of following all of our visit there last month. So I'm excited to kind of talk about that a little later. But I'm personally very excited for this show and this topic because I don't think I've talked about it much on the podcast, but my PhD was actually in functional neuroimaging. And so I've kind of been watching you release these papers and kind of following along. And I'm very excited to kind of see this topic that's very, you know, near and dear to me to be kind of impacting radiation oncology. Maybe we can start. I know that we were going to start by talking about the ASTRO abstract, but maybe, Jonah, do you mind just kind of explaining the goal of your lab and what the overall arching like kind of mission is? And then we'll kind of jump into the specific work.
Yeah, sure. First of all, I think it's so awesome that your PhD was in this topic, Matt. So I'd love to, looking forward to hearing your insights on it as well. Probably been studying this longer than I have. But, you know, as a clinician, really the work comes from really trying to understand, you know, the dogma that radiation causes brain injury and, you know, we're really potentially harming patients. And, you know, how we can really understand, map and prevent or treat, radiation induced brain injury and what's actually happening with a cognitive neuroscience framework. So that's really the goal, the overarching goal. And as a clinician, I really want to help understand what patients are fearful about, how I can improve their survivorship, how I can maintain their function, their ability to work and speak and drive and use their hand and play piano and all the things that are important to them while we're treating. And I think that that's something as a field, we are so imaging based and we do so much with imaging and sort of like using the imaging that we have and we're obtaining to create really precise and more cognitive sparing, cognitive relevant radiation plans.
Yeah, and it's actually, it's surprising because, I mean, my work, I did fMRI studies of movement disorders and then the motor system in healthy people as well. And so it was really just mapping how the basal ganglia are involved in grip force and grip control. So we did these very simple experiments where people would go in an MRI machine and like kind of press on a little button with different force levels and they'd follow kind of a visual feedback kind of cue to do these tasks in the scanner. And it was sort of mapping the role of the different basal ganglia nuclei to kind of and how they control acceleration of force or deceleration, release, grip release, that kind of stuff. And then we moved it over to Parkinson's patients. That was kind of the kind of end of it and one of the things that drove me to go to medical school. And then when I got there, I looked at neurology and it wasn't a field that was for me, mainly because I felt like I wanted to do more treating. I know that neurologists treat things, but it's a challenging field where there's not a lot of great treatments for a lot of the conditions. Right. And then neurosurgery, of course, is like the other correlate. And I knew people say like you kind of learn very quickly in medical school if you're a surgeon or not. And I'm definitely not a surgeon. So I knew that pretty quickly. I was happy to find radiation, but I was surprised when I got there that like the neurosurgeons do a lot of functional imaging and surgical planning. for their surgeries, right? And then I got to radiation oncology and I realized that we do a lot of SRS, which is just radio surgery, right? But we don't really do it the way that they do. And so I was excited to see your work because it really feels like it moves our field in that direction where you might, for example, plan a treatment around if a person's right-handed and they greatly value their right hand, fine motor control, you may, adjust the way that you're treating based on that. Neurosurgeons do that now. And so I was kind of surprised that we don't, but it sounds like we're getting there.
Yeah, that's what we hope. Yeah, totally.
So can we talk a little bit about the ASTRO abstract, Austin, that you presented? That was this year, correct?
Correct, yeah. So it's kind of building off some of our other work where we've looked at other areas, different domains of cognitive function. This one was specific to attention and processing speed. And what we were looking at in this case wasn't necessarily picking up on different biomarkers of damage, but noting that these areas do have damage after radiation from previous work we've done, and trying to combine all that information with our planning data to see if certain structures were more sensitive to that radiation and if those specific parameters like mean dose or max dose correlated with who was getting toxicity in that domain after radiation. And what we mean by that is, these patients would undergo neurocognitive testing at baseline, as well as 3, 6, and 12 months after treatment. And we could see some patients were having greater decline than others. So using 3 different types of machine learning, we built models to basically try to predict what regions were correlated with that toxicity and also remove all the collinear variables in this situation. Because as you can imagine, all these structures are right next to each other, but finding the one that is most predictive of these side effects is the one that we can actually potentially clinically implement, because you can't just say, yeah, we want to reduce dose to everything in the brain. That just doesn't work, but you can pick one over others. And so what we found was that certain areas of the corpus callosum are actually much more strongly predictive of neurocognitive decline than basically any other clinical variable we looked at. That's including concurrent chemo, adjuvant chemo, even different types of tumor, whether it's like a benign CNS malignancy or an aggressive one where you think that could also be impacting their CNS function. So it's just interesting that it was such a big difference compared to everything we traditionally think of as also causing side effects for patients.
Yeah, and I think it's really cool work. And I have to let you know that there's 2 things that always go through my mind when I read these. One is, I think there's a whole important body of work that looks at methodology for these types of modeling studies and looks at different methods. And so I can admit that when I was doing kind of modeling research back in my sarcoma days, I sort of was more involved in it. But these days as a practitioner, I tend to think more about how am I going to use this model and incorporate it into my practice. The other thing that I find that's really interesting and makes it really hard to link this work to the clinic is because I always look and see what you all are testing, and you have a really nice setup where all of this data is actually coming from prospective studies. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So really what you're doing is you're taking the dosimetry from a prospective study. So it's going to be pretty high quality dosimetry. And then you're also linking it to these objective tasks that people have to do. And I think if you don't work in this space, you kind of forget. And so I sort of looked up just a couple. But for example, for this one, you did the Hopkins verbal learning test as one of the tests that you looked at related to dosimetry. Is that right? Or am I getting,
Not for attention and processing speed.
Okay.
So all of these patients get a complete battery across multiple domains, but specifically for the one at ASTRO, it was different portions of the DCAFS testing. So it's including the trail making tests, color word interference. And then we also, in this situation, they also do Boston naming tests and things like that. But the memory tests were specific to a memory project. That was actually last year's ASTRO. We discussed that one.
Okay. Sorry, I got mixed up with the
papers
where you do this stuff. And there was also a pegboard test as well. I saw with the fine motor control paper that you did.
Exactly.
But I saw, I wasn't going to dive too deep into those because it's a little bit in the weeds for the purposes of this podcast. But I think sometimes people forget that it's not when we talk to patients about attention and processing, it's actually a very specific thing we're asking them to do. Right. And so I saw that the Delos Kaplan executive function system, I looked that one up and it's a frontal lobe function test. So how do you, when you have these results and then you apply them to your clinic, how do you discuss this with patients, or what kind of things do you tell them? If we can make it easy, like for example, with hippocampal sparing, right? That has a very specific task that they asked them to do in that clinical trial. We found benefit there. How do you explain that to your patients with these kinds of findings? Is that making, hopefully it's making sense with my question.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think just taking a step back, like the way that we approach this is with like a cognitive neuroscience framework, right? So we're not just saying like, how are you thinking today? Or how are you feeling like you're thinking, which is also important. And we also look at that, you know, in terms of quality of life and even depression and anxiety symptoms. But we work with a neuropsychologist. And so we designed the study and all of our, like sort of like our mapping papers and the work that we've done is really to look at exactly what you said, Matt. So saying like, if we're going to look at what subserves attention, we're going to do tests that actually are testing for attention. And sometimes what happens is what we find out on the testing is that a patient actually doesn't have a problem, let's say with their memory. It's their ability to attend to a task that's actually the problem. And so you're really getting very objective data and objectively testing somebody to figure out, oh, is your problem with executive function, like not being able to plan or carry through work? You know, is that really because you're not being able to attend to a task? Is it you can't plan your day? Is it you can't remember short-term memory? Is it that you can't, recall words or is it speaking? And so I think that's like the different parts that we're lucky our team, you know, we work with a neuropsychologist to kind of figure out what that and, you know, how to test those things. But in terms of like how to put this in place in the clinic, that's what the work that we did is trying to dissect. So as you said, like for fine motor, we didn't just ask people like, you know, well, how do you feel like your right hand's functioning? We actually measured it with this group pegboard test. We did dominant versus non-dominant hand. But then what we can find from our results, like what Austin showed, is that if you really wanted to spare attention and a patient's like, hey, you know, this is really important to me, or how is this going to affect my attention, doc? Like, oh, how is this going to affect me? You know, we all have that like could impact your thinking on the consent form, but it's like, it could be very little or it could be a lot, depending on where, you know, a billion different factors, but definitely in terms of where we're putting dose. And so I think it can help you figure out, okay, you know, you have a tumor right up against the corpus callosum. You're already probably having some attention changes. This could get worse, or I'll pay really close attention to this part of, no pun intended, the brain, you know, and really, and try to create a plan with whatever technology I have at my disposal to really push dose away from that part. So I think that's kind of where we need to take that next step. And that's where Austin's project and then the fine motor paper is really saying, not only have we mapped what region we think is responsible, but we know what structures in those region and what dose we should limit it to. So you don't really need to understand the tests per se, just more like what specific function you're impacting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And I like that because I think what I was trying to get at, and I sort of asked my question in a choppy way, but it's, we've all seen the patients, right, where they're like a right-handed patient, they have a left motor strip tumor, they might have some tingling or numbness in their hand before surgery, they have surgery, it gets a little worse and then maybe better as it healed. And then you treat them and you, it's easy to tell them what could happen if there's a recurrence or swelling in that area or for toxicity from radiation. But then if you go to like the frontal lobe, right? What I love about this is it's so much harder to describe that to, you know, and I would say we started off by saying the neurosurgeons do a good job of mapping and planning surgery, but I don't know that that's necessarily true for things like attention, right? Where they do a much better job for things like fine motor control, which is mapped a little bit more simply. And so that's what I think, hopefully people are taking that away from what you said, that if you look 10, 15 years down the line, we might have specific strategies and to spare parts of the brain to help with this function. You can imagine a patient who has a tumor near the corpus callosum, but not, you know, harming it or causing symptoms. We may want to try to modulate the way that we put the beams in to try to minimize dose there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's what Austin's paper, which was really interesting. And then the fine motor paper too, like you were talking a little bit about like, you know, methods, right? Because there's so many things that can impact how you think, right? And your age, you know, whether they got chemo, whether you're having patients are having seizures, whether they're on steroids. And he looked at all those variables all at the same time in these models and found that I think what's really exciting is that these dosimetric variables actually came, the rose to the top, right? These are the ones that are really impacting functional change. But what's great about that is like, we can fix that. Like we could actually do something about it. Because if I just had to tell a patient, listen, you're 70, there's nothing I can do about it. This is going to happen to you no matter what. Or you're on anti-epileptic medications. This is going to happen no matter what. But if it's dosed to a structure and we have the ability to change it and actually create functional sparing plans, that's the data. Like Austin's data is what we need to drive the field forward, right? And to say, oh, I can change that. Like, and that's where we get back into the room, just like what you're saying, like the neurosurgeons do. They do language mapping, they do awake surgery. They, you know, patients are playing their violin while they're having their resection. I mean, like, there's so many like super cool things that we're doing in neurosurgery that I think we should be doing in neuroradiation oncology.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I just one quick like methodological point, that one thing I always had looked at when I started to see these papers come out is, well, how do you tease out if it's just the tumor causing these issues, right? Because obviously there's a correlation there. If the tumor is in the corpus callosum, the dose is going to be in the corpus callosum, right? But you actually remove the tumor from these analyses. So really you're looking at spill of dose outside the GTV or the PTV, or which do you know?
So what we're censoring in that is tumor as well as significant edema adjacent to it.
Okay.
So you're still getting some regions that are going to be within your PTV, but that's also the normal tissue that we are just targeting basically as a precaution, right? Because we assume there might be microscopic disease there. So it's stuff that is close to where we're treating, but also excluding the things that could affect how we are actually analyzing everything. So tumor and edema are all taken out.
Yeah. And to be clear, I don't think it's like a perfect method, because I do think that just the presence of the tumor, you know, I do think that my own opinion is that these are probably networks, right? And if you put a tumor in the network, it probably messes up the whole network in some way or changes its physiology. But I really like that aspect of your methods, because I think it does a nice thing where at least it tries the best you can to tease out that question. Like, is this just from the tumor, or is it really coming from the radiation dose, or both? Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. And another thing we did is we also look at like different structures all at the same time. So like, you know, Austin's paper looked at different parts of superficial and then deep white matter and deep white matter tracts. The fine motor skills paper that you're referring to that we published is looking at like cortex and superficial white matter that are responsible for motor function. And then the corticospinal tract and the basal ganglia. We looked at the cerebellum. So it's really kind of looking at, and, you know, in our mapping here, we recently published like a paper on the cerebellum. None of those patients really had cerebellar tumors, but there was dose and impact on function. So it's not, while we're able to censor, you know, tumor involvement and we adjust for like the tumor type and all that in the model, as you're saying, yeah, there's no perfect way to look at it, but that's true with like any NTCP study, right? Like right. Any like cardiac, lung, it's always kind of true. And I think you hit the nail on the head there. Like, how can we really know? But then it's also impactful to be like, well, then that's dose you can control, right? Like maybe you could potentially have that impact. I think we just need to push the field forward to like, you know, derive this evidence and put it into practice, put it into trials. And I do think part of it is just like we, as radiation oncologists, I mean, you kind of alluded to this before, feel like, okay, maybe this is, we just think about the brain as one whole thing, like it's one parenchyma or structure. And it really isn't, right? There's networks and there's different functions of those networks. And then what makes up that network? There's cortex and white matter, what's more susceptible. And the hippocampus is just one small part of that network, but it's not like the only thing that's important in the brain.
Right. Yeah. And I wonder, so that's actually a nice segue to the other thing we were going to talk about, which is just examining neurotoxicity using image biomarkers, right? The one comment I would make is like, I think for maybe trainees that are thinking about starting to do work like this, just modeling toxicity and radiation, it's a big challenge. But I would argue that you actually have a harder challenge than most or maybe all of our colleagues, because if you just envision like, so I used to be like a lung guy, if we just take pneumonitis, for example, there's lots of challenges with pneumonitis, but the reality is that it's kind of a yes, no, like they either have it or they don't, you grade it. And it's a set of symptoms that it's a clinical diagnosis and we get it. The, again, challenges, but then if you go neurotoxicity, like you just said. I mean, that really encompasses everything about a person's function in terms of how they interact with the world. And so can you describe a little bit just kind of how your lab is approaching this and how you're tackling such a challenging problem?
Yeah. So so one is kind of what Austin alluded to before is really, you know, when we're mapping it, we're using these biomarkers to understand injury and what's happening. And, you know, what we found is like, white matter is actually way more sensitive than we thought. It's super sensitive to radiation. It's super dose sensitive. High doses cause precipitous injury. And then what's also interesting, we found like low doses actually even do cause injury if you wait long enough. So it's sort of like these patients who are the long-term survivors who then come back and say, oh, I'm having this and this problem, you know, 1, 2, 3 years out. It's probably real. You know, there probably was some impact of some of that low dose fill. So really teasing out again, the different structures, the different networks, what, and then the other question is like you alluded to, which is like, what is functional loss, right? Like, so for like, you know, pneumonitis, we have, you know, CTCA criteria, you know, dermatitis, other itises, other toxicities. So for cognitive outcomes, in cancer research, it's kind of interesting because different trials use different thresholds, like, some trials, and that's actually kind of why I think we need to have a unified approach to how we analyze it. You know, I have a neuropsychologist on my team and she and I come up with like our system of like, this is true clinical decline. And this is just kind of like within the standard deviation of the test. Like if you took a test, Matt, before and after you drank a cup of coffee or like before and after you had a really good night's sleep, there's going to probably be some deviation. I think all of us on this podcast would have, but it's really defining, okay, this is what deterioration, this is what functional loss really looks like. And what is that standard of care in oncology? And you're right. Like, you know, do you power a test or a big trial of hippocampal sparing, for example, on one test and one score on one test? Or do you do it on a range of tests? Like, you know, the hippocampus is important in memory, but if you're looking at, you know, if you're the hypothesis, it's neurogenic stem cell loss, and that subserves a lot of different processes happening in the brain, attention and processing speed and executive functioning, then why are we just looking at one HVLT score? We should be looking at a lot of these different tests or a conglomerate of tests. And it is, you're right, it is a lot more complicated, but I also think it's a lot more exciting. And I mean, I'm biased, but I think that's why it's been fun to kind of map these things individually to really get in there and say, like, what test are we going to use? What is true decline and what isn't? And what's important for patients? Because I think for some patients, you know, you could be really high functioning. You're a young patient, and we've all had these patients, super high functioning, working full time. Any loss, right, is a big impact versus somebody who's already has a pretty big hit neurologically because of their tumor, and maybe a small but objective loss may not have a significant decrement in their functional, you know, well-being.
Yeah, and I think that's a nice comprehensive answer, and it's really a great thing that you're undertaking. And I you know, one thing I really do like about this is how practical it can be, right? Because, you know, a lot of times we're talking about, you know, trials that might implement a new product or a new like device or a new protocol that not everyone can do, but you're really just talking about altering sort of treatment planning that we're already doing. So maybe we can pivot a little bit. I know that you have this phase 2 trial open. What I'm speaking to specifically is the image guided cognitive sparing SRS for patients with brain metastases. There's a publication out there, but it's a trial protocol pub, right? You haven't released any results yet from this trial.
Yeah, that's right. So this is an NCI funded trial from our R01 that's currently accruing and will be reaching full accrual very soon. And Austin actually updated that at ASTRO, and we'll be updating that at SNO this year as well. And so he'll comment on that maybe in a minute. And the idea basically is, let's take all those white matter structures and those white matter tracks that we now know are important and we know why they're important. We've mapped them and put it into practice. Mm-hmm. And what the way I kind of conceptually came up with this idea was, if you look at, you know, randomized trials of SRS versus whole brain, the cognitive deterioration rate, even on the SRS only arm in the Alliance study, was 64%. which is kind of crazy. I mean, 64% of patients who are getting SRS are having cognitive deterioration. And I think that part of that is probably because we're ablating things and sending dose, even with radiosurgery, potentially to things that are important for functioning. I mean, maybe that's part tumor. Maybe that's a lot of things. Can we make SRS smarter? Can we, you know, especially with SRS, because you have a defined target, you're not chasing, you know, big margins, you don't have edema, you shouldn't be treating normal tissue. So that's what we're doing in the trial. And it's the COG SRS trial. So it's the first cognitive sparing brain SRS trial. It's a phase 2 study. It's really kind of like my baby that we've been running here. And Austin's been amazing at pulling together all our data. And our data should be forthcoming soon. And you're right that what you said a minute ago about like the work really isn't about like you have to use this technology, you have to use protons, or you have to use an MRI LINAC, or you have to use this. It's really just sort of like, and we've talked to Simil about this too, it's sort of agnostic to your whatever technology you're using. So anybody can do sort of functional sparing, but we need to make it evidence-based. Yeah. And, you know, I think the trial, I hope, will have some, you know, compelling outcomes compared with what we know isn't good enough for patients. And then how you push that forward at your place, whether you use Gamma Knife or CyberKnife or whatever, you know, is up to you. But we'll put the, you know, we're starting that process of making, bringing that workflow to patients.
Yeah. And I think I was just going to say, just again, like to kind of be, if people don't work in this space at all, they may not be aware, but what you're doing is you're just getting a regular MRI that has diffusion weighted imaging, which I think every or most centers can do. And then you're using an automated tool to kind of do what's called tractography, which is kind of delineating the white matter tracts in the brain. You would fuse that to your planning scan and it just becomes a structure. That white matter tract is just an avoidance structure in your planning, right? So this is like, it's, you know, my feeling is like basically every center that can do a brain MRI could do this. And if they have a brain MRI, a neuroradiology program, and then like a, and then kind of an SRS program, that's really all the tools that you in theory would need. I mean, I don't know that I could do this tomorrow, but my center has all those things and we could do it, I think.
Right. Exactly. And Austin, do you want to talk a little bit actually about that? Cause I feel like you've kind of looked into like,
I think the big thing we talked about regarding this trial at Astra was that we're actually doing this and it's not impacting clinical workflow at all. It's not causing any undue delay from getting the MRI and the SIM to actually treating the patient. Cause just like you mentioned, it's just something we add in to the planning step. It just goes along with any other structures we're looking at. And obviously, like if, you know, tumor or PTV is right over a tract, that's when, okay, well, we can't spare that because we still have to treat the disease. But it allows us to optimize the plans for basically every other tract we're considering. And it doesn't take any longer to plan and treat these patients. And
so you don't have like a room full of like med students and residents contouring out tracts in the brain.
Correct. Yes.
His whole research here was just sit down and contour.
That was the censoring for the tumors for the other project. And yes, I did all of those. So.
Yeah, but you're right, Matt, it's all automated. And like, you know, these things exist. It's tractography. It's tractography that surgeons use for planning. Why can't we use it? And you're right. I hope that people will be more excited about it. I hope that, you know, people listening to the podcast will, it is fun to talk to people in our field because I think people really, I think as radiation oncologists, we really want to improve outcomes. We're good with imaging. We're good with technology. We can adapt to different platforms. And I think we do hope that this is something that could be used kind of.
I want to let Simil say what he was going to say, but I just want to say really quick that I bet you this is going to have a big impact on patients where we're doing single or multi-ISO, multi-target SRS, which seems to be becoming ever more common. And I bet you that you're getting low intermediate doses to a lot of these structures and being able to control that better, I think may have a big impact in the future.
Well, and I think that was one thing we found when we took an extra look at it is some of these structures that were within 1 millimeter of the PTV, we went over just our point max dose constraint, but just by knowing they're there, we can keep it under like a 0.03 cc max dose by a large amount comparatively to what it was otherwise. But we don't know to do that if we're not looking at these structures. So, right.
It's no surprise that when anyone brings up the topic of billing in radiation oncology, we'd all like to just hit snooze on that conversation. Manual billing review is not only time consuming, but can also be incredibly confusing. Thankfully, there's a better, faster way with Quick Code by RadFormation. The software automatically reviews all the charges in your R&D for accuracy. But not just that, it verifies proper documentation, approvals, imaging status, and more. By proactively identifying billing errors, Quick Code helps departments maximize their revenue. Visit RadFormation.com to learn more.
Hey, John, you guys are speaking at a very high level. I'm going to bring it down to community rural doc level here for a moment. I did my residency at UPMC, and we were allergic to whole brain, right? Like, that's just, they were using CyberKnife and Gamma Knife. In 2008, I think, might have done a 27 MET case or something like that. And it was just this idea that whole brain is bad. And conceptually, like, even at that time, like, you're giving the exact same dose to gross disease in the brain as you are to uninvolved brain, right? You're just giving the whole thing 30 gray. There's nothing, even with technology, like, we didn't do anything different. We didn't give any boost dose or anything to gross disease. And then the next step was this idea of like hippocampal sparing, which, you know, that study had like a marginal benefit. It had some benefit. And it's just like, Garrett, you just spared these couple of horns in the brain, right? Like, but all this other brain was still getting radiation. And you guys are talking about like the network effects. Like, it's so complicated. Like, I will never begin to understand how, as much as you guys know about like the tracts and the neural circuits, it seems like it's almost like above human understanding how that's going to work and trying to pick out the tracts. And I'm not saying like, I am excited to see what your study shows, but it seems so, so complicated to try to say like this one structure to spare that or to have like a DVH constraint on that and whether or not that's going to have a benefit down the road. And like, I think this is good. Like, we did have to get there, but it seems like there was a middle part maybe in like the 20 teens when we could have been like boosting those tumors and like dropping the rest of the whole brain down to 10 gray or something like that, or whatever, you know, you could pick some dose. But it just appears to me, like, based purely on my experience and time in training and time in practice, the less dose you give to the brain, the better the patient looks after treatment. And it's just like, it's as simple as that for a lot of it. I'm just kind of wondering what you'd say to that.
Yeah, so I think you're totally right. I do think that, like, you know, based on kind of what we were talking about before and what you just said, like, you could do hippocampal avoidance, right? And you're sparing this 5 millimeter contoured area around the dendrocytes, but you're like, you could be giving full dose to the corpus callosum, the parts of the brain that are involved in language and all these things. And then the patients are coming back and they're having problems with attention or language or other things. And we know that even the hippocampus, it doesn't function on its own, right? It's connected to the fornix and the cingulum, and there's a memory sort of site, there's a network, there's an afferent, efferent, there's like things that go into that structure. And if you're not sparing those, then what's the point? So again, in brain mets, yeah, I think SRS just treating the metastases you see, obviously far better. We know that SRS versus whole brain in terms of cognitive outcomes. But then even what Matt just said, like, you know, there's lots of different ways you can do SRS. Some people are using bigger PTV margins and think, okay, this is fine. Your PTV could be going right into a critical white matter tract. And then, you know, when you are treating 27 METs, you know, which you're still giving, there is a whole brain dose. It's like 4 gray times 1 or something, right? You're given something times 1. And what is that doing, right? Yeah. Over time. And then I think the other part, Simil, that you didn't touch on is sort of the primary brain tumor patients. And that's where, like, I think as a field, we have to evolve from these glioma 2 centimeter margins, these huge margins, and not really confining the margins to critical networks or structures that we know we're just needlessly potentially irradiating. And I think you hit the nail on the head that there's some complexity, but there's stuff we can do about it. It doesn't have to be super complex. And there's probably like incremental steps that we can take before we're doing super complicated cognitive sparing that just involve like margin reduction, you know, doing less, how you map out your isocenters, you know, how you're planning your radiosurgery, who are candidates, how you're spacing out radiosurgery. Is it multiple, you know, small doses of radiation that contribute to the neurocognitive decline? Or is it like one whammy and then waiting a long time? You know, I think there's a lot of questions, a lot of ways we can evolve, but we have to like care that it's important, measure it, and actually have like evidence-based data to like put into practice in the community as well.
Yeah, like I had a case that kind of Matt kind of knew about it too, and it just briefly, this happens in the community a lot, is for whatever reason you can't get an MRI or a good MRI, right? Like, and that's just not something you face over there. That's just not something that happens. Like it's common for us. Like even you know, I'm 50 miles from a large city. I've been in Phoenix area. It's happened where the patient won't get it or they refuse, and you see one thing on a CT scan, and does that patient get subjected to whole brain? And like, I know we need functional imaging and we need comprehensive imaging, but man, whole brain is so bad. And you know, like any brain getting radiation to me, like the way I was taught is like, oh, it's bad. That's bad. And so, you know, we occasionally, and I think in the community it happens, we do SR, not quite SRS, but multi-fraction brain mat treatment with the CT. With the contrast CT, and it might leave people aghast, but the closer you are to community practice, the more normal that is, I think, and the further away you are from it, that might not seem normal. Like, we are super worried about toxicity. In the community, that's our biggest thing. That changes your referral patterns. You have too much toxicity, you're gonna have a problem. And so we are really worried about this stuff. And this is, you know, at times more important than improving outcomes, because nobody can tell when a patient's cured more. But they certainly can tell when you turn them into, you know, vegetables or whatever, you know. After.
I think what's cool though is like that case that you just described. I mean, that generated so much discussion. Like we have a little, just so you guys know, we have a little like group chat where we kind of talk about radiation oncology type stuff and cases. And you can imagine that even if you didn't have that MRI, the data coming out of this lab could alter the way you think about that case, right? Because it's not like you lose all concept of brain anatomy without the MRI. Like, you know, kind of the vicinity of where these things are, and it may even affect your decision further, just depending on where in the brain it is, that kind of a thing. So you're totally right that some patients may not be able to take full advantage, but I feel like this is one of these things where it's kind of like when hippocampal sparing came out, at least for me, it sort of shifted my thinking, the way of you know, how I approach these cases and think about toxicity in the brain related to radiation. If you asked me 3 years ago, I would have said, oh, we're running way too far ahead with SRS, but, you know, whole brain's kind of going away too quickly. Is it safe to do so? Now I'm kind of the other way, where I fully believe that, you know, my practice, at least, we try to SRS, you know, everyone and avoid whole brain at all costs. And I'm not so sure that's wrong for like the vast majority of patients these days. And my thinking is still evolving. And so I think even in the situation you discuss, you may think about it differently based on this data. You know,
but the kind of cool thing you guys are talking about, it's this great confluence of things that are happening right now, right? Like, you guys are doing this functional or functional MRI imaging has been going on. You guys are doing this project, AI with contouring tools and learning the structures, and a bunch of things are like happening at once, where we have the technology, we have the Linux that can do it, you know, RIP ViewRay, but there, you know, there's going to be ways to do this. And it's really exciting. Like, I didn't mean to say, like, I don't think these structures have met, but we care about toxicity a lot. Like, yeah. This is super important to us. And it's going to be really interesting to see, because I think this can transition well to us with the help of tools like any of the auto contouring software. It's going to be super helpful. Like, you guys can help identify things for us, and then we're going to be able to transition. Because the hippocampal sparing, let me tell you, I got friends that are my age that won't do it. They won't do it. They're just like, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to get the MRI fused. I can't identify the structure. I'm not kidding. These are guys in their 40s. And that's too bad that they're not even taking that time to learn that this potentially decreases toxicity and makes the patients do better. And so I'm optimistic and hopeful for what you guys are going to be able to do here.
One other thing, I think that's a great point you both made. You know, thinking back to your case of like, okay, well, let's say you're in the community, you don't have, you know, you don't have some fancy brain MRI with diffusion tractography and all this stuff. It's really kind of just thinking about, well, one, how you counsel patients, because you kind of have an understanding of like what's going to happen, where the tumor is. And a lot of it, like, we had one paper that we've also published recently on the cerebellum. And I think there was this understanding that the cerebellum really had no cognitive relevance at all. It was really just important for coordination, motor coordination, ataxia, et cetera. But we actually looked at like biomarkers of injury and mapped and found that like dose to the cerebellum actually impacts attention, even when you look at the corpus callosum and all the white matter. And I met a friend at Astra who treats head and neck cancer. And he said, when that paper came out, he's like, I treat head and neck. I don't even treat brain. But I actually totally use this in my practice. I really try to avoid the cerebellum. And you don't need a fancy MRI to do that. Anybody can see the cerebellum on a CT. And it's something that we could do now for patients even beyond brain and brain mets, right? This is like head and neck, nasopharynx, other things, base of skull, parotid. So I think it's just really understanding, like, trying to break down the brain a little bit more. And I think similar, you're saying, like, it's going to be hard for some practices to break it out into a million different parts. But even if we could subsegment, hey, this part's pretty important for this function, you know, even those people that you were saying that can't get the MRI and can't fuse it, they could put that into practice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that's the thing, that transition is going to be, that translation to us is going to be really important.
So I have one question I wanted to ask just about your lab and your work. One thing that is constantly front of mind for me is that people talk about chemo brain in the clinic. There's very little written about this, I think. I mean, there's definitely some studies that are coming out maybe more recently, but there's just less attention to how maybe systemic therapies affect cognitive functioning, despite the fact that every patient will tell you that it does. So in your lab, is this something that you guys are thinking about, or is this something that you're just trying to control for in your studies? Or what are your thoughts there about just the interaction with systemic therapies?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It does impact it. And we know that historically. And I think kind of thinking like big picture, I mean, a lot of the reason why radiation oncologists, we know so much about radiation toxicity in the brain is because we care and we look at it and we examine it and we study it and we talk about it, and it included our consent forms and, you know, like everything we just discussed. And I do think it probably gets brushed aside to a certain extent with systemic therapies. There's a range probably of degree in terms of systemic therapy, more cytotoxic therapies versus targeted therapies, IT therapies, lots of different things cause toxicity in the brain. So it's something we're trying to parse out in our studies, and Austin's done some work on this too. In that project he was talking about earlier, where we kind of looked at different variables and actually found that with the radiation variables, even when we controlled for the type of chemo and how much chemo they got and when they got it. But I think you're absolutely right. I think all these things do. Mood impacts functional status and functional. I mean, you know, another project that we did, which I thought was like super cool, that is I think also really exciting, is just like how a patient feels impacts how they think and vice versa, right? So like, what if we could just make a patient feel better? What if we could make a patient less anxious? That could have effects on their cognition that you don't need fancy machines and fancy MRIs to impact. You could do in the community. So there's so many different ways to look at cognition in addition to, like, you know, how we're giving chemo, being aware of when they're getting it, what they're exposed to. And I think that's why, like, our studies, though, we look at pre and post radiation at numerous time points, and we're able to keep some of those chemo variables constant and really look at what's changing to kind of parse out what's from radiation, what's from chemo. But you're absolutely right. The latter does have an impact.
I just feel like I had to say that.
Yeah, no, you had to say it. I mean, we all know it.
We all know it. But this is really fantastic stuff. And I personally am very excited to keep following as stuff comes out. Well, it sounds like you said you'll have some important updates maybe about your trial later this year or next year. We'll definitely keep an eye out for those and look forward to discussing them in the future. Yeah. So I think we were kind of heading towards the end of our hour here. Simil, do you have a lightning round for him?
A few questions. So I had dinner this weekend with a lovely doc, GI doc. He told me he went to med school in Boston. I think he went to the same med school you did, Jonah. Do you say you went to med school in Boston, or do you state the name of the so-called medical school?
I guess it depends on who's asking. It's different when you live in San Diego, because like when I was in residency, I did my residency training at Harvard. You wouldn't just be like, oh, I went to medical school in Boston. People would be like, well, where? So yeah, I mean, I think I do. I'm probably somebody who does say that from time to time. And then when a patient or somebody else asks, well, where? And then I'll say, I've been gone from Boston so long now. So it doesn't come up that often, but.
On our trip to San Diego, you gave us an excellent recommendation for fish tacos. You want to tell us a little bit about that place? And it seemed like the funny thing is everybody in the medical community mentioned that place on their list. So it sounds like a consensus. And after going there, we agreed as well. That was awesome. I would have went back again. And tell us about that place because it's such a...
It's so great. Austin, have you been to Oscars?
That's what I was hoping you recommended because I would have been 100%.
Austin and I can disagree about a lot of things, but if we disagree about the number one fish taco place and where we would send you, then I think we'd just have to
be problems.
So the place is called Oscars, and Simmel was staying pretty close by. They have a few different locations, but their original place is on this street in La Jolla, really close to the beach, next to a vape shop, and they have like the most incredible fish tacos, like smoked fish, octopus, shrimp, ceviche. That's a really big thing. What else do they have? Like scallops?
The scallops ones? Oh, yeah.
So good, right?
Yeah. And the thing, I've had fish tacos in the past, but very greasy, heavy. This almost was like a tempura batter sort of thing. It was like crispy without feeling greasy and heavy. And it was awesome.
I couldn't believe that. I mean, that place was so hyped up on social media prior to going to San Diego. Like everybody said, I think even Aaron Goodman, who's been on the show, he's a medical oncologist. I think you probably know him. He said that place independently, I think in a separate conversation, kind of separate from the radiation oncologist. And then we went there twice and it like totally delivered. I was very happy to see that. And so we will probably be going back to San Diego, maybe just for those tacos and some other things too, but yeah.
Yeah, it's really so good. The salsa is amazing. And part of the eating experience is you're standing on a beach next to the vape shop, standing while eating. So like it's like the right clientele that you send there. It's definitely not a bougie sit down, or you take them to the beach and you just go to the beach and you eat them there. So.
All right, Austin, your residency photo, you have just a brilliant mustache. Oh, are you going to be doing that for this November?
So that is a result of the mandatory N95 fitting. And what I did was look up the CDC recommendations for maximal allowable facial hair for N95 fitting. And that's what I came in with. And then I found out the next day we were taking our residency photos. So
it reminds me of one of my attendings who was the lead radiation oncologist on the NSAVP early studies, like B6, Mel Deutsch, Dr. Deutsch. And he, you know, we'd kind of tease him about it. He's like, what are you talking about? I look like Errol Flynn. And he's like, Austin looks like Errol Flynn.
All right.
I don't know who he is.
I'll take it.
I didn't realize how close San Diego was to Tijuana until this last visit. Any good Tijuana stories, preferably about Jonah?
I bet Austin has better TJ stories than I do. So amazing Baja fish tacos if you go down to TJ, and then Ensenada, which has like amazing food. And then one thing I really think people should try when they come down here is drive to Mexican wine country, which is called Valle de Guadalupe, which is about an hour from San Diego. And it's sort of like Napa, like 20 years ago. It's like amazing wine, amazing food. We went last year, we even took our kids, loved it, and lots of great food. You can do day trips. I've never done one, but Austin, have you done them? They're like these food tours you can do from TJ.
I know one of my co-residents, Asona, has done that a lot. I mean, I even went to undergrad down here in San Diego and I still skipped TJ at that point in my life. But like going to like Rosarito, like lots of good beach places with good fish tacos again. You can definitely get down there. If you're spending a lot of time to get to Ensenada in the wine country, you might want to make a whole weekend of it, but it's all just really easily accessible, which is nice.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to exploring that part. When we live in Phoenix, we used to go down to Rocky Point and drive down through there, through that part of Mexico. It was really interesting terrain and really pretty. So when I was in when I was a med student, UCSD didn't have a program, but I was at like UCSD Midwest because it was, I wrote my first rotation was with Dr. Mutt, Lauren Mell, I think like Joe Salama was there. Basically, it was UCSD before they moved to San Diego. And what was most memorable, other than like Dr. Wakshawan being hilarious fun to chat with, was the great dinners Dr. Mutt used to take the residents and students on for you know, journal clubs or events or anything like that. And it was so nice. I just felt like, oh man, one day I'll be able to afford these restaurants. You know? I was just wondering how is that? Is that still happening? Does he still take you out? And,
so any kind of events have honestly like just started up again, because I mean, I started PGY2 in 2020. So I was just coming down from working in the Fresno ICU for a couple months and we were not doing anything with anybody. A lot of people will work from home if they weren't in clinic. So it's slowly like ramped back up towards more social things, more in-person meetings, things like that. But I definitely remember from when I was a med student here, everyone was having a lot more of those. And so we definitely want to get them back on track.
Yeah. The journal club we went to this like fantastic sushi place in Wicker Park. And I remember Dr. Mutt just raging against the CALGB breast emission trial. That was the first time it was published, when it was just like a 4% versus 1% difference or something like that. Just like, they're trying to get rid of us. And, you know, 15 years later, here we are having the same discussion.
Right.
You know, I guess. This is fun, guys. This is super interesting stuff. This is going to be like, I can't wait to bring you back on when this is published and look at the outcomes. And then when this is phase three too, because I know this is the future and you guys are doing it. It's really cool.
Awesome. Yeah. We're going to maybe start getting into some educational type webinar type things. So maybe you can come on and teach people how to do functional sparing and in the brain, like in a couple of years, once all this data is sort of sussed out. But I think this is really fantastic work and I'm pretty excited to see it.
Awesome. Yeah, no, it's been really fun. And I'm excited to hear that other people are interested in it. And it's been great having great collaborators and residents like Austin working on this too. Hopefully we'll have some exciting results in the next few months on that trial.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much. This will be out soon and we'll talk with you all going forward.
Thanks for listening. If you liked our show, please subscribe and leave us a rating. Also, head to photonmedia.org and check out the rest of our content. We hope you're having a great day and look forward to seeing you again soon.